playing around with historical fiction.
One thing I do like about working with history is that you can have anybody appear in your stories. That's something that I do in this collection. We have random people appearing in other people's stories constantly.
Even fairies. That's Sabina Murray. Later in the show, we'll talk with her about her collection of historical short stories about explorers, Tales of the New World. But first, we'll talk with Sadie Jones about her historical comedy, The Uninvited Guests. It's a kind of Edwardian supernatural romp.
I like your use of the word comedy because I thought of it from the outset very much as a comedy, not because it has gags, but just because it's, it's sort of in the mold of a comedy with a capital C, of almost a Shakespearean comedy.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. British novelist Sadie Jones is known for her historical fiction. Her first two novels, The Outcast and Small Wars, take place in the 1950s. While different in their themes, they share a tragic sensibility that explores the dark corners of the human psyche. Her new novel, The Uninvited Guests, is a more comic take on those dark corners and goes a bit further back in time. It features a slightly eccentric family living in a country house in England at the turn of the last century, the same Edwardian age and setting in which the PBS series Downton Abbey takes place. The action concerns a kind of supernatural house party that unfolds over the course of a weekend. The Guardian called The Uninvited Guests a, quote, happy marriage of ghost story and country house drama. But this rollicking romp of a book explores some serious themes. Quoting again from The Guardian Review, quote, the conventions of middle-class English manners are revealed as too flimsy an overlay to hide the filthy passions and cruelties that seethe underneath. The cruelties, I may add, that all flesh is heir to, even when that flesh itself is decomposing. Sadie Jones, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This was such a different novel than the one that we last talked with you about, which was Small Wars. Just for our listeners, tell us a little bit, give us a sense of what the story is about, and then I'm also going to ask you to talk about its characters.
Yes, it's the story of a slightly eccentric family who live in a country house in England at the turn of the last century. They're Edwardians. The daughter of the house is having a birthday party, and she invites some quite conventional friends to stay. And then the whole event, where they're all trying to be as respectable and sensible as possible, is sort of derailed by a train accident nearby, and the survivors are sent up to the house to seek shelter. And the dinner party is sent into chaos. And one of the survivors used to know the mother of the house in some capacity, and he sort of causes mischief.
So this is kind of a manner comedy. I mean, here this book is appearing at a time in America which has been addled by Downton Abbey fever.
Yeah.
Is that something that you...
Addled is possibly a good word. It's a weird thing, I suppose. If it works for me, that's wonderful. I started the book in 2009, so it was long before any of this, the whole kind of Edwardian fashion. But I suppose a lot of people were starting Edwardian work at that time. So I guess it's the zeitgeist.
Yeah, that really could be. And manner comedies are, of course, to some degree, and I don't know if I'm using the word comedy properly, but I can't think what other genre to give it, but are very much about class. And in this novel, The Uninvited Guests, class does play a role, but it's not in the same way that it does in the others. It's not kind of out there in a very striking manner, but there is an undercurrent. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, there is. I like your use of the word comedy because I thought of it from the outset very much as a comedy, not because it has gags. But just because it's, it's sort of in the mold of a comedy with a capital C, of almost a Shakespearean comedy.
Yes.
So it's not really jokey, but it is, it's the lighter side of life, even though it has its dark undercurrents. And as to the class thing, I suppose I didn't want to write what I think is such a cliche of the landed gentry in the house who've been there for generations. That's actually such an unusual thing and not something I'm particularly interested in. This family are, they've come from a mixed background. They are all different sorts of things, and they're quite strange. And I think it was sparked by a statistic I read a few years ago that said that there's more movement through the social economic classes in this country than in any other country in the world historically. And I was amazed by this because we are sort of seen and see ourselves as so class-bound. And I thought that was really fascinating and a very modern idea, too, that we are all, I think we can all relate to the idea that we're just clinging on to our mortgages and our houses and, moving through society, not just stuck in one time. Yeah. And I think we often look back at history and think, that's how things were then, and anybody who lived in that house would have always lived in that house. But I wanted to capture something of the transience of the age and also of our age.
Yeah, so these are, I guess you could call them parvenus. This is a family that bought a manor when they were able to do it, a bit of an extravagance. Now they're facing losing it, not being able to pay their mortgage. The class differences, the housekeeper, for example, has been an old acquaintance of the mother of the family, Charlotte, for a long, long time. In fact, they've been friends. So it's a marvelous mixture. But now tell us something about these characters. The protagonist, I think you'd have to say, is the middle child of three in this family. Tell us about her.
Well, she's Emerald Torrington. It's her 20th birthday. She's responsible. She's actually the eldest child. She's responsible for the others. Her mother is rather kind of flaky and a bit of a narcissist and sort of a monster. I enjoyed writing the mother tremendously because I think I didn't judge her, but she's a slightly monstrous creature. And Emerald is, the daughterly response to that sort of an immature ego that is the mother. She's having to be the grown-up for the family, and she tries to be practical, and she tries not to be silly, and she's sort of thinking about being sensible, and her dreams are to be a scientist, and she's not sure, given her surroundings and her situation, if that's the way, she doesn't think she can do that, and she's given up her dream when we meet her at the beginning.
There's Emerald, there's Clovis, also her kind of self-indulgent older brother, and Smudge. I just loved Smudge. Tell us about her.
Well, yes, Clovis is the younger brother who is spoiled and bratty and kind of terrible, partly because he's grieving his father, but also just because he's vain. And then there's the younger daughter, Smudge, who, because she's so much younger, she's almost 10 years younger than they are, gets to have the sort of freedom of neglect. And I think it's something that in our age of helicopter parenting and, don't climb that wall and you can't possibly do this. Smudge is left alone with matches her whole childhood. And she's very much the better for it. She's a very happy, strange, obstinate little child. And she draws all the outlines of the animals in the house. There are a lot of animals in the book, and they inhabit the house, the cats and the spaniels and the horses and everything. And she has these charcoal drawings of all the animals on the walls of her bedroom. I loved her. She was great fun for me.
I don't want to give too much away, because this is a novel that very much hinges on a shift in perception by the reader that comes on slowly and is really the critical point. So we won't go into that other than to say it's a kind of delicious horror story underneath.
Yes, it's a story of mounting chaos, really, I think.
Mounting chaos. Say a little bit more about that.
Well, while it isn't a class-bound respectability, it sort of is. They're trying to keep a veneer on everything and have the proper birthday and do it all nicely, and they're invaded by these survivors from this crash. And as everything deteriorates in a physical way, but also kind of metaphorically, there's just a... How would you describe it? Everything collapses. almost physically around them. The food, the mess, the everything. They're understaffed. They're overworked. And sometimes writing it, I felt it was a projection of my own life as a mother and writer, and you know, trying to manage in the world and keep things together. I think a lot of women can relate to a story where there's just never enough beds or food or organization to go around.
Oh, absolutely. I can relate to that very well. You know, it's interesting what you say, though, about, you know, the mounting chaos and the breakdown of things, because there is a scene in the book which I do want to talk about and don't think it'll give anything away, where there's a kind of parlor game that is played.
Yes.
That totally strips off the veneer of, you know, friendliness, of, you know, good cheer, of politeness. Mm-hmm. It's quite horrifying. I actually found it acutely painful to read, possibly mm-hmm. because, you know, I, like, you know, many kids, was a butt of bullying when I was a child, and I found it very difficult to read this and fascinating too. Can you talk a little bit about that scene?
Well, it's a game that I'm not very good at making up things like this, but this game just came to me very easily. It's the dinner party, and there's this naughty character who's sort of infiltrated the ranks of the party, and the game is called Hinds and Hounds. It's based on deer hunting with dogs, which I've never done but had to research, where the pack of dogs will separate a deer from the herd in order for it to be killed by the other dogs. And this game is where the guests are made to turn upon one another by pointing out their differences, which seems at first sort of benign and sort of all right, that you might say that one person has different colored hair or wears glasses. But actually, the moment you start doing that, the moment you separate people, and in this story, a sort of bestiality comes out, and everybody is almost turned into those dogs, and it becomes quite cruel very quickly.
The beast in me is caged by frail and fragile bars, restless by day and by night, rants and rages at the stars. God help the beast in me. The beast in me has had to learn to live with pain, and how to shelter from the rain, and in the twinkling of an eye, might have to be restrained. God help the beast in me. Sometimes it tries to kid me that it's just a teddy bear, and even somehow manage to vanish in the air, and that is when I must beware of the beast in me. That everybody knows, they've seen him out dressed in my clothes, patently unclear. If it's New York or New Year, God help the beast in me. The beast in me.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Sadie Jones about her new book, The Uninvited Guests. It's a comedy that takes place in an English country manor at the turn of the last century. but its droll exterior conceals some mordant observations about the evil people do. You say this scene came to you, this story came to you. Can you say a little bit more about, you know, what role this scene plays in the book?
It's a scene, because it is a comedy, but it's a comedy that has a sort of dark and quite nasty underbelly. And I had to, there were certain turning points, and this game was a point where the bad side of these characters is shown to them, and it's a sort of unveiling and unmasking scene. And you were talking about the good side and the bad side of them, and in a way it was a morality tale. I thought about J.B. Priestley and Inspector Calls and those sort of late Victorian Edwardian morality stories. And I didn't really want to do exactly that. I wanted to play with that and not stick to any genre. But I did want to... There's a vein running through, the current running through the story is that they're refusing to look after these people who've come. They don't want to look after these poor, shocked passengers who've turned up. They sort of shove them off in another room and try to carry on with their party. And they can't really be rid of the passengers until they accept that they must look after them and until they become kind. So in a way, it has that kind of morality tale shape to it.
And it strikes me that that's also a metaphor for class. You know, the ruling class thinks that it can insulate itself from the impact of its policies on, you know, the 1% yeah. think that they can insulate themselves from the 99%. But you look at history and you can see that that's not true.
No, that's exactly right. And I didn't want it to be some sort of, you know, there's a huge amount of fun about it. But there had to be a spine of real meaning, otherwise it's just a silly, fluffy thing. And I suppose that at the heart of it, it was saying, you know, we ignore one another and we ignore hardship at our peril.
Right. We're talking with Sadie Jones about her new novel, The Uninvited Guests. It's just out from HarperCollins. You know, I read in the material that came with this book that the idea for it came to you in a dream.
Yes. The house came in a dream. I woke up from a dream about the house, which is a very specific house. It's not just kind of any old manor house. It's a particular house. It's sort of two houses joined together. It's a bit of a mishmash of a house. And I woke up from this dream, and I realized that I dreamed that particular house at least twice before, but with different people or with me being a different person. And I just thought it was like being given a big present. I thought, wow, that must exist somewhere. That house really, it's somewhere out there, and it's being shown to me for some reason, and that's my story, that's my next story, and it was very exciting. And then I had to go about the process of wondering who lived there and, you know, what they might be like and kind of interview myself about the house. And I realized that when I had dreamt it, I had dreamt different times. And so it automatically became a story about shifting time. That's where I suppose the metaphysical element came from.
You mean more than that it was set in a previous time?
Yes, that people were... Oh, maybe I'll go back to that house and tell another story there, I don't know. But it seemed to me that the house is the... I had to do a short story for the BBC that I got commissioned for one of the festivals. And it was while I was writing the book, and I couldn't think of anything else except the house. So I wrote, I wrote an earlier time in that house. Where, because there's the old house at the back and the new house built on the front. And I wrote the owner of the old house meeting his architect there in the snow and to discuss the building of the new house. So it must have been, it was about 1740 or 1760. And I wrote a story of that, which didn't work very well as a short story, but it pleased me because I have this idea that the house is permanent and the people are just passing through it.
Wow, that's so interesting. You know, for many years, I had a recurrent dream of an apartment, of a vast apartment, of the apartment that I lived in, although it was never the actual apartment that I actually lived in. But an apartment I lived in, and I opened a door, and I suddenly discovered that it was much, much larger, that there were all these undiscovered rooms in it. And it was always, I loved these dreams because I always, you know, woke up with a marvelous sense of, you know, wonder and discovery. And I began to realize that the dream was about myself. I mean, that the house is actually a metaphor for us. And I thought of that with the house in this book that is here composed of, you know, a very old house that nobody goes in anymore and a new house.
Yes. And the idea that, you know, one might join the other or be separated from the other or that you might demolish the other. This idea just, it's mysterious to me, but it resonates completely with me that it's what we do physically with buildings and with the landscape, but it's also what we do with ourselves. Applying new selves and about life and death and how we replace and replenish and add on and decorate and occasionally destroy. It meant a lot to me, and it was you know, good to explore it.
Yeah, and actually there's a point where, you know, where there is a breaking through from the new house to the old house, and a very satisfying ending there, something, you know, everything is integrated in a very lovely way.
Oh, good. Thank you. I'm glad. It was really tough, you know, because it was so much fun to write. I had a kind of sense of anxiety about it, that it was never easy, but it was fun, and that it has slightly come too easily. And I came back to the first draft to do my first sort of proper rewrite and realized that it just wasn't doing the job the whole of the second half. And I had to do what I've never done before, because normally my first draft, I mean, it's not perfect at all, but it's, you know, the structure's mainly there. And with this book, both of the other ones nearly killed me at some point, and this one nearly killed me in the rewrite. And once I'd been through the fire and made that second half really work in the way that you're describing, then I thought, okay, good, now I've got a book. Until then, I felt that it was just sort of, there was something too soft. It came too easily.
It's so interesting that something, you know, after all, that's, you know, just a plot twist can also change the tenor of a book. Not change it into something it wasn't, but all of a sudden you find that you're in a much deeper place than you thought you were to begin with.
Yes, well, I think that you know, the first half of them is always about promises, isn't it? You're laying foundations and promising and there's that sense of the future. And then if you don't deliver, you know, on all the levels, as far as you can, then you're cheating the story and you're cheating the thing that you said that you could do. And I hate, as a reader, having that feeling that somebody's, you know, that it's full of possibilities and then it just doesn't quite, you know. And as a writer, what I find the toughest thing to do, but the thing that I have to do, is just push into that extra gear that this book does towards the end.
Yeah, and it's just a delightful read. The Uninvited Guests, Sadie Jones, thanks so much for talking with us about it. You know, I wanted to ask you, are you working on anything else at this point, or are you taking a rest?
No, I don't do rest. I've started another one, and then I'm also writing another draft of the Outcast screenplay for my first book, which is in development again as a film. So I'm sort of doing lots of things at once.
And you are a screenwriter also, is that right?
Yes, well, I was an unemployed screenwriter for years. So I couldn't desert my first novel and just let someone else do it.
You were an unemployed, is that why you turned to fiction?
No, novels? I didn't mean to turn to fiction. I just I found myself doing it. I think I just in a way I was kind of learning how all those years. But I do enjoy screenwriting, so it's nice to have two things to do.
Sadie Jones. We're talking about her new novel, The Uninvited Guests. I'd like to ask you, what was the difference for you in the experience of writing a book like Small Wars and writing The Outcast? Because in some way, I think they're in the same, you know, camp or same field. What was your experience of writing, the difference between writing those and writing this new book, The Uninvited Guests?
Well, I don't see the first two as similar as other people seem to think. I guess because they're both set in the 50s. And they both have a male protagonist, and both those male protagonists are suffering. I can understand that they put them in the same place, but they were very different books to me to write. In a way, I suppose when people talk about the writer's voice, and I have always felt more that it's the book's voice. And this book, The Uninvited Guest, just had a different voice. It was a different job to tell it because it was set in a different time. And even though I planned it for ages before starting and imagined it, I didn't really know what the voice would be until I began it. And that the main difference, I think, between this and the other two is the language. And this I was incredibly liberated by being able to just play with the vocabulary and with, you know, this. I mean, the other books probably used 100 words between them. And this, I was, you know, all over the dictionary. And I really loved being able to do that because it was appropriate for the story. But it wasn't really a choice to, you know, I didn't think I'll just do something different. I just had to do the thing that was presented to me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you said that because I did want to mention, I just found the language absolutely stunning, playful. It's fun. It's, you know, you want, I think I read it in one sitting. I wanted to find out what happened next. It's a great yarn. But there's so much pleasure in the language in this book and in just the sheer, as you say, the vocabulary of it. So thank you so much for mentioning that.
No, well, thank you. That's really pleasing because it was something, you know, that I took pleasure in and was also immensely challenging.
Well, the book is The Uninvited Guests. We've been talking with the author, Sadie Jones. Thank you so much. I look forward to your next one, and I so much enjoyed this one.
Thank you. Thanks very, very much.
Sadie Jones writes fiction in the UK. Her novel, Outcast, was a finalist for the Orange Prize for Fiction. We spoke to her about her novel, Small Wars, in 2010. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to that interview. You can also see a book trailer for The Uninvited Guests and read a passage from the book. Next up, we talk with Sabina Murray about her short story collection, Tales of the New World. Stay tuned.
Today I am a small blue thing, like a marble or an eye, with my knees against my mouth, I am perfectly round. I am watching you. I am cold against your skin. You are perfectly reflected. I am lost inside your pocket. I am lost against your fingers. I am falling down the stairs. I am skipping on the sidewalk. I am thrown against the sky. I am raining down in pieces. I am scattering like light.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Many have pointed out that all memory is fiction. Could we also say all history is fiction? History tells a story, and stories are how we humans make meaning. And we color those stories with the meanings that we make. In her collection of stories, Tales of the New World, Sabina Murray mines the rich lodes of history and fiction to extract the golden ore of meaning. The subjects of her stories are those who set out to discover, conquer, and exploit the territories of the other. Ferdinand Magellan is viewed through the lens of a scholar and companion who lusts after him, yet is unable to save him from himself. The Victorian age explorer Mary Kingsley is beset by selfish relatives and vindictive fairies in England, but finds herself a real home in Africa. One reviewer wrote of the collection, "With her signature blend of sophistication and savagery, darkness and humor, Sabina Murray investigates the complexities of faith, the lure of the unknown, and the elusive mingling of history and legend." Sabina Murray is the recipient of several awards, including the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. Tales of the New World is her fifth book. She teaches fiction at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Sabina Murray, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Great to be here.
Tales of the New World is a collection of stories, of 10 stories, that take as its subject figures in actual history and then invents stories around them. Could you talk a little bit about, just first of all, the process? Why did you take this approach? I mean, even just apart from the content of the stories, the approach of working with history in this fictional way.
I look at history, we all look at history, and we all try to figure out how we got where we are, having lived through these historical moments. And I think that it's important to get a perspective on that. Where we are, we're at some kind of breaking point, I think, too, in terms of the written word. Is people are largely saying that, you know, it's the death of the written word. It's, you know, we're moving into these new boundaries, that it doesn't really matter where you're from in the world now, that there's a homogenous sense to being a citizen of the earth. And I don't really buy that we're there yet. But the fact that people even view this moment in history in those terms is kind of curious to me. You know, what we thought was futurism even 10 years ago, we're sort of living in it with the internet and all of these things that, you know, I'm not the best person to talk about that particular kind of expansive futurism. But from my perspective, as somebody who likes to sit in her house and read books, it can be kind of scary to look at the future. And it made me go back and think about what it was like to be an explorer, because in a sense, those people were moving into realms that they didn't know about. And what they do is they go and they witness, and then they write it down, and they bring it back. And when they bring it back in the written form, you know, there's a story about Magellan where I have his chronicler, Pigafetta. Pigafetta writes a book that is disseminated widely, and people read it, and they get very excited by these images of naked women and, you know, and giants and all these other things, you know, different constellations. And it seems to me that at that point in history, maybe people were feeling the same way that they do now with this rapidly expanding world.
So another time that was a flexion point in history, and, you know, you've already alluded to this here. This is a series of tales about explorers, except for, well, even with that one told from the other point of view, the last one in the book, which is told from the point of view of those who are being, quote, discovered, unquote. You tell these stories in layers where it's not just about the explorer, but there is also the figure of the narrator. As you said, Pigafetta. There's another narrator in one of the stories. In the story Periplus, this is a narrator who is a little more contemporary to us, who's writing in the 50s and 60s, a young seminarian who has your last name.
Well, this is a very funny story. And that I wrote that story for my father. My father was in a Jesuit seminary in the 50s and early 60s. And, you know, that's when I said I was writing this collection of short stories about explorers. My father, you know, he's an academic. He was an anthropologist, retired now, but also retired into teaching philosophy for several years at the University of Southern Maine. And he, you know, he said, oh, I wrote my undergraduate thesis on this explorer, Hanno. And I said, really? And he said, maybe you're interested in this explorer. So I said, sure, I want to take a look at this. And he produces from his papers this brown folder and these yellowed pages. And it's kind of excruciatingly typewritten at some far remove in his life. And, you know, all the Greek letters that are put down have to be written by hand into the paper, because that's what they did then, and it's about the explorer Hanno. So I looked at his paper. It was very odd. I'm reading something that my father wrote when he was, 19 years old, 20 years old, and it was just a very odd feeling. So I tried to write about Hanno, but I don't know that much about Hanno. And there isn't that much to know about Hanno. It's interesting from the perspective of someone translating out of the Greek. So I ended up...
And tell us, who was Hanno?
Hanno was a Carthaginian explorer. And he explored down the west coast of Africa. And the things that he saw, we don't really understand what they are. He said he saw these hairy gorilla-like people. And people aren't sure until this day if those were actual gorillas or they're gorilla people. So they're not sure what exactly was being witnessed at that point. And he writes about, you know, mountains within lakes and lakes within mountains. You know, these things that we're not really sure what that means either. Was there really a mountain with a lake, with an island, with another? It ends up being kind of more of a metaphor that gets used in literary criticism, you know, Hano's lakes and mountains, rather than something that you would actually expect to be carried back, you know, a real part of geography or history that gets carried back by an explorer. So I really didn't know where to go with that. So then I just thought, well, I'll just write about my father writing a paper, which as a, you know, for some reason was wildly exciting to me. When I actually started writing it down, it ends up being, why do we engage the classical world? Why do we look to the past? Why do we look so far to the past? And just these crazy ideas that people have about, you know, ancient Greece. You know, if you talk to, we all think that we inherited things from ancient Greece. We all think we do. If you see where the Elgin marbles are and the big fight about that, it's because the English truly believe that this civilization, Greek civilization, ought to come to England. And where the Greeks are and all of that is, you know, anybody's guess, especially how things are now. But this idea, you know, we keep engaging the classical world. And then I look at Michelangelo, who, you know, the whole Renaissance is about engaging the classical world. And
you should tell us the context in which Michelangelo appears in this story, Periplus.
One thing I do like about working with history is that you can have anybody appear in your stories. That's something that I do in this collection. We have random people appearing in other people's stories constantly. Michelangelo makes an appearance because while he was working on the Sistine Ceiling, the Laocoon was unearthed.
And what is that?
The Laocoon is this, it's a statue of Laocoon, who is a priest of Troy, and his two sons. And, you know, he angers the gods. You know, some people said that he has sex with someone in the temple. I mean, he does these things that anger the gods. So the gods send these snakes up the beach, and the snakes entwine Laocoon and his two sons, who, writhing and being in such pain, create the inspiration for a very famous sculpture, which is actually the sculpture that, you know, it does these things that, you know, the Greek art of the time is really innovative. It shows human emotion, and it's not a placid human emotion. It shows the torture of what it is to be human. And you pit that against, you know, these placid gods, you know, the tension between realizing your full self and your best self and being beset by base human emotion, which is this huge innovation in art. And of course, this is Michelangelo sees this and he begins to really play with it. And so in my story, Michelangelo comes across the Laocoon. He says, what can I do that's new? Look at what has already been done. And I think that this is the basis of a lot of torture that artists, writers, everybody has. You're coming up against this stuff all the time. What do I possibly have to add to this?
And yet we do derive so much of our art from history, not in a negative sense, but in the sense of inspiration.
Absolutely. And just to try to humanize these people, what happens is through the course of history, all the edges get smoothed off of some of the most interesting people. And so, I want to look at Michelangelo in a moment where maybe he's feeling vulnerable and insecure. I mean, you know, Michelangelo is a complicated guy, and we know that he didn't wander around in a, you know, bathed in this sense of purpose and assuredness. That's not even how he comes to us in history. But I still would like to peel off a couple of other layers and, you know, see him viewing this great work of art and having a moment of insecurity. That, to me, is fun.
And that's just a moment in the story, Periplus. I'd actually like you to read from this story. I'm going to ask you to read from the top of 194 to the middle of 195. So maybe take a moment just to look at this and see how you want to set us up with it and tell us who the narrator is and what's happening. And we are talking with Sabina Murray about her short story collection, Tales of the New World.
Okay, so this is from Periplus, and the narrator is a young seminarian who seems to bear a strong resemblance to how I imagine my dad would have been at this point in time, having retreated from society and being very committed at this point to being a Jesuit. And of course, what happens in this story, a lot of it is, you know, why do you even write papers? What is scholarship? All these things. In the story, what happens is he's trying to unlock simple truths to get the paper down, and they keep blooming into larger and larger truths, making him wonder who he is and what his purpose in life is, which I think is actually, I think about that a little now. I thought about it a lot more when I was 19. There was a thought, I am what makes it all happen. There was another, I am without meaning. Which was Sturm und Drang, which rationalism. This is all very funny, and he laughs. He knows that while the 50s and 60s, with their attendant dances and tunes and sexual mores, play on outside, he is happy in his library. This is reprieve. On the wall is a painting, a respectfully muddied oil of Saint Ignatius relinquishing his sword, giving it up to God. He is no longer soldier, not yet saint, not yet founder of the Jesuits, not yet inspiration to the seminarian, yet to be born, yet to be inspired. He is merely a disillusioned soldier, receiver of injuries, survivor of prolonged recoveries, who is determined to follow in the path of Saint Francis, although Ignatius, or Inigo, is not a big lover of animals and likes his shoes, as future Jesuits will like the occasional Mercedes-Benz. In the picture, Saint Ignatius has fallen on one knee. On the other, a sword is miraculously balanced. Something hidden behind a woolly cloud has caught his attention. The saint's face is a confusion of awe and decision and duty. Did Ignatius, falling upon his knee, politely wait for God to appear and accept the gift of peace, inaction, and identity shedding, a gift of willful innocence, as if the battle and bloodshed had never happened, and a new man? Was this his destiny? Did destiny contradict free will? Free will, that gorgeous, flawed, and slippery cliff's edge upon which all men travel, defines both him and his relationship to God. There is response to this that he should know cold, that should save him from having to parse out what is faith, not to be questioned, and what sits in the brain like sand in an oyster, the stuff of meditation and philosophy. Destiny. Is that something to fear or something to dream on? Our seminarian stares hopefully at the picture of Ignatius, as though the answer might exist within it. This painting will not help you, says Ignatius. It is but a metaphor. A lot of good art, and, he looks around at the dun-colored sky, the static rendering about him, even much average art is composed in such a way as to tell the story rather than present a specific moment in time. It would be unfair to restrict a painter in a way that a writer would never submit to submit to the reality. I never fell upon my knee like this. Our brotherhood of Jesuits was not formed with my arms flung wide, my mouth open. We were an intense lot and met in Saint-Denis, in Paris. It was a meeting of the minds. All right, no more daydreaming. Take the pencil. It is your destiny. Take the pencil.
I chose this to ask you to read it because it just has so many of these layers and threads that we've been talking about. I mean, the question, you know, what is destiny? What is meaning? I mean, destiny is something that is imbued with meaning. Destiny is how we give meaning to the things that happen to us. Otherwise, they would be just chance. You're talking about art, and you're talking about scholarship, and you're talking about the mundane and the metaphor. So I kept on thinking that, you know, more than you imagining how your father or riffing off what your imaginings of your father were in writing this character, you were also talking about yourself. Is that right?
Yes. Well, of course. It's very hard to think about my father at that age without giving him all the thoughts that I have at my age and that I had at a younger age. And also because when you look at a parent and you know them well, but you can also see the kind of course their life has taken, it does make you think about what their destiny was, and it makes you think about what your destiny will be. And it's very hard to look at the life of, you know, my father, for example, which had so many twists and turns, and not think that when I look at my own life, I don't know what's around the next bend. We all live in that sense of the sense that we're in control and that we know what we want and that we will always want these things that we now want. But as you get older, you realize that is not the case. Your wants change frequently. And you never, 10 years earlier, you would never think that you're doing what you're doing now, or rarely. So it did give me it almost, looking at a parent does give you an opportunity to just look at what life means and, you know, all the large questions that get wrapped up in your own life.
And these stories really do examine the large questions. We're talking with Sabina Murray about her collection of short stories, all linked, stories of exploration. It's called Tales of the New World. I think actually my favorite story is the first one in the book. It's called Fish. It's about an explorer named Mary Kingsley, who I'd never heard of before, who explored West Africa. She has to travel very far away from her native England to find out who she is. Tell us about this story.
Mary Kingsley was not destined to be an explorer. We're talking about destiny. And she grows up in a very closed family situation. Her mother is ill, and her mother seems to have decided, as happened to a lot of women in the Victorian era, that the purpose of having this child is to take care of her and to keep her company, and then to also take care of her brother and to keep him company.
And I just want to ask, is this something that really happened, or is this what you imagine in the story?
This really happened. It's funny because most of the people that I do write about not only have several books written about them, but usually have written their own books. And with Mary Kingsley, she actually wrote 3 or 4 books, and I've read a lot of her stuff. And her voice that comes through is just kind of humorous. You know, I can't believe I did all of this, and I wasn't destined to do it. She's very chipper and tough and refuses to feel sorry for herself, ever. She just doesn't have any self-pitying bone in her body. And I really respected that when I read her work. She is there in her house. Her father travels widely. He's a surgeon, and he travels around with various English nobility while they do their wild travels. They need, a personal surgeon. And so he's been to the United States. He's been to the Rockies. He's been all over the South Seas. He comes back, and he writes these kind of little books that don't do that well. And he has some rather famous brothers. One of his brothers is Charles Kingsley. He wrote these Westward Ho and The Water Babies. And so she grows up with, you know, in this one of these eminent Victorian families, but being a total footnote. She's a girl. Nothing's going to happen to her. Mary, she doesn't even get to go to school. She just gets to hang out in the house all day. And then, in a very short amount of time, her mother dies, her father dies, and she has no idea what she's supposed to do with her life at all. So having spent her whole life with her imagination, she just decides to go ahead and do what she wanted to do, which was go be an explorer in Africa. And it's almost because nobody cares about her that nobody bothers to tell her she can't do this. She's become so expendable that if she wants to go expend herself in this way, nobody even has an opinion about it. So she won't peddle religion. She's not a religious person. She never has been. So she can't be a missionary. She refuses to be. So she actually does get some very good practical advice, you know, which is don't go wandering around Africa without a purpose. No one will talk to you. Go sell things. If you go there as a merchant, it'll give you a role, and that'll be a good thing. So she decides that she's going to sell whiskey and tobacco.
A good choice.
Yeah, in the far reaches of West Africa. And she goes places that nobody else has been at all. She also never leaves behind traditional dress. So she's there in her corsets and her wool and her lace-up boots. And she's, you know, knee-deep in these very swampy areas.
And she also has a very different attitude towards the so-called natives, unquote, than probably a lot of her fellow explorers. Isn't that right?
She really identified with the people in her group and the people that she met. She didn't find them that alien. And that's not that's not my invention. That's, if you read her works, you really do see that she has a deep, abiding respect for every way of life. And she doesn't come in there and try to civilize people. She just wants to learn about them. And she really feels very, very comfortable in that situation, dealing with a chief and an interpreter and trying to sell things. She feels at the top of her game. If you put her in a dinner party, she's a mess. She always gets into arguments back home. She makes a lot of enemies. She's incredibly awkward. People do love her. I mean, she's a very lovable person. But ultimately, she just is most at home in West Africa.
And so tell us about the fairies.
Oh, yeah, there are fairies in that story. I was rather surprised to see fairies pop up in that story, too. But part of it is, you know, narrative strategy. She's alone so much of her life, and I didn't want to leave her alone. But also because I grew up reading this Charles Kingsley book, The Water Babies, was a huge part of my childhood, and there are fairies in it. And I thought if she had spent her life with books, she would be thinking of fairies. Also, I think fairies are scary. They're not cute at all.
Yeah, these fairies are extremely scary. In fact, I wondered if she was manic depressive, if this was actually that she, you know, she was hearing voices.
Well, yes, she could possibly be hearing voices, but, you know, part of me is just one reason I'm a fiction writer is I can say, you know what, the fairies are fairies. In this lady's life, she has these little people who haunt her, and they're there. They're her only friends in her childhood, and they only show up at her moments when she's completely alone. So I also thought that it was, I wanted to create a real Victorian story, and I thought the Victorians loved fairies. They were into that. So I'm just going to put them in there, and I'm going to let them stand in the same level of reality as all the other people that have been researched and, you know, everything, all the research that went into the story, what people wore, what they ate, just the stuff of that story. There was so much research done to just do the inventory right for that story. So I thought, you know what? It's Victoria. I'm going to put some fairies in there.
And why do you find fairies scary?
Well, they know her most intimate thoughts. They're very limited in terms of their, you know, they have no intellect, but they are extremely cunning. And I just thought that they don't really want the best for her, but they are very attached to her. And that also replicates kind of the sense of that family to me. That family can do that to you. People are very attached to you, but they don't necessarily want the best for you all the time. And so I decided to explore that, those complicated bonds with the fairies.
Then you have a story of people who left all their family behind to join another family and therein lose their lives. You look at the story of Jonestown. This is a much more contemporary story. I remember it well. First, for those of our listeners who might not remember it, it's the source of the phrase, they drank the Kool-Aid. Tell us the story and what's your fascination with it? Because also there's the narrator very much puts themselves, is engaged with the story in a very personal way.
Yeah. The Jonestown Massacre happened while I was a child, I think 76. Yes. And I grew up in Western Australia. And you feel very isolated when you grow up in Western Australia, because to get to other parts of Australia, you need to go across the Nullarbor Plain, this wild expanse of desert. And when people would go across that desert, they would have to bring gas. They'd have to pack, we called it petrol then, big canisters of petrol into the back of the car to make it across the Nullarbor. On the other side, your closest neighbor was Singapore. But you have like a shark-infested sea between you and Singapore. So you got everything through the news. And the way I just thought about my childhood memories for that was, what are the things that have constructed who I am? You know, people always ask me, why are you always fascinated with the dark things in life? And why does history form like the backbone of so much of what you do? And it really started very young. I remember seeing the film footage of Jonestown and being horrified and not being able to peel myself away from the screen. And this was also before the days when we had many screens. You had one screen. So your parents wanted to watch the news. They didn't say, we're watching the news. Go pick up Dora the Explorer on your computer screen. You watched the news with them. You saw what real fear was in your parents. You learned about what it was to be connected to the world in a different way. So when I was there experiencing their emotions about Jonestown and mine, all those little kids lying face down, you know, it really did, in a way, you know, say, did it traumatize you? Yes, but in a good way, because I felt connected with the world. I felt that those people could have been me. I didn't feel isolated from them. I felt sympathetic in the deepest way. And, you know, it changed my experience of the world. And I think about other things that affected my childhood that also make an appearance in the story Paradise. Idi Amin. I remember watching the film footage of Idi Amin day after day and just hearing these horrifying stories about, you know, first when he kicked the Indian population out of Uganda, and that was, you know, that was smaller than when all the other stories started to come out about how he was hunting people with lions and feeding them to crocodiles and all of these other
killing
things.
His wife and sewing her legs on backwards.
Yep, for infidelity. I mean, these are just all things that I was aware of as a child. And I also seem to have a very good memory for when I was young. It's just a strange thing. I really remember well what it was to be 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So the paradise for me ended up kind of being, how are we connected to the world? And also why the reason it ends up in a book about exploration is, why would he go to Guyana with all these people? Why not Utah? Or, I mean, not that there aren't a lot of people. Maybe Utah's been done by people. It's over. Utah's so over. But, you know, why Guyana? And what was in his mind? Did he think, was he like the pilgrims when they came to the New World? Was that what was in his mind? What philosophy takes you out of your country with your belief system and launches you into another? There are just so many things that were curious to me about that. So I started out trying to write a very straightforward story. You know, I think I had African-American family who was living in Indiana. And then I just said, this is not what I can do well as a writer. I'm sure there's some other writer out there who can do a fantastic job with that story. Not that we shouldn't stretch ourselves as writers, because I do try to have characters from many different backgrounds. But what I could do was try to contextualize it into this moment in history, what fear meant in the mid-70s to a child that was, you know, 8 years old, what fear meant. So that's where I went with that.
Yeah, and it seems that throughout this collection, you're really wrestling with that idea, what does history mean to us? How does it reveal to us or help it? How is it kind of the boat on which our own feelings can kind of journey to a new place or even a very old place that tells us something more about ourselves?
Yeah, there's a lot of that is because history is shared in so many ways. You know, we operate under this fallacy that we all share the same approach to history. You know, we go into a classroom and they say, okay, this is, you know, the Revolutionary War and this is what you need to know about it. And then we all think that because we all sat in the same class that maybe we all left with that same history. We share that. But you don't. You share some elements of it. But then it becomes very personal. And how you interconnect with it becomes incredibly personal. So that's, I was also interested in that, how we personalize, how we make it our own. Everything we learn about the world, how it becomes almost an exercise in who we are.
Well, it's a fascinating collection. It's very, it takes slow and careful and pleasured reading to read this wonderful book, Tales of the New World. Sabina Murray, thanks so much for joining us here on Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a really fun conversation.
Sabina Murray writes and teaches in Western Massachusetts. You can read an excerpt from Tales of the New World at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.